Flying to the Philippines had taken Cabrillo and Franklin Lincoln a little over 14 hours. Getting from the capital, Manila, to Tubigan on Bohol Island, in the center of the 7,000-plus island archipelago, had taken almost as long, although the distance was a little more than 300 miles as the crow flies. Juan knew from experience that the proverbial crow rarely flew in third-world nations. Because ground transportation couldn't be guaranteed on Bohol, they had been forced to first fly to nearby Cebu Island and rent a sturdy, if aged, jeep and wait for the ferry to take them across the Bohol Strait. Link had remarked that the ferry was so old, the tires slung over her rusted sides should have been white walls. The boat had a pronounced list to starboard, despite being loaded intentionally heavy on the port side. Any thought of sleep during the crossing was nixed by the tractor trailer lashed next to their jeep, loaded with pigs that suffered mal de mer even in these sheltered waters. The smell and their squeals were enough to wake the dead. Twice during the crossing, the engines inexplicably went silent. The first time was for only a few minutes. The second lasted nearly an hour, as crewmen under the eye of a snarling engineer tinkered with the machinery. Worrying about surviving the trip was a welcome distraction for Cabrillo. It allowed him to stop dwelling on Max's fate for a while. But when the engines belched to life again, his thoughts immediately returned to his friend. The irony wasn't lost on him that Hanley's own father had died in the Philippines defending Corregidor Island in the opening months of the Second World War. Lincoln could read the anxiety etched on Cabrillo's face and tried to raise his spirits.
"Listen, Chairman, this is our best lead yet. There were 400 responsivists here for God knows how long, and now they're all dead, most likely so they'll never talk about what they were doing. We'll find what we need and get Max and his son back."
Juan appreciated the pep talk, but it did little to make him feel better. That would come only when Max was back aboard the Oregon and Tom Severance and Zelimer Kovac were nailed to the most convenient outhouse door. The ferry staggered into the harbor, slamming into the wooded pilings in one of the worst displays of seamanship Cabrillo had ever seen. 10 minutes later, with the boat secured to the dock and the ramp lowered, Link fired the jeep's engines and they eased onto the quay. They immediately opened the windows to dissipate the pig smell that had permeated the vehicle.
"Good a time as any," Juan said, and put his foot up on the dashboard.
He rolled up his pant leg. The prosthesis he wore was a bulbous, ugly limb of flesh-toned plastic. He pulled the leg free and unlaced his boot, pulling it and his sock free. There was a tiny hole in the bottom of the prosthetic foot. He plucked a small Allen wrench from his pocket, inserted it in the hole, and turned it counterclockwise. This released a mechanism built into the leg that allowed him to split open the calf like an old-fashioned lunchbox. Cached inside what he called his smuggler's leg were two Kel-Tec pistols. Cabrillo handed one of the diminutive pistols to Link and slipped the other into the small of his back. A small block of plastic explosives and two detonator pencils set at 5 minutes were also in the smuggler's leg. Juan had found over the years that when his prosthesis set off airport metal detectors and he pulled up his cuff to show the limb, he was waved through with an apologetic smile every time. Although they hadn't encountered any bomb-sniffing dogs on this run, he was ready for that contingency with a small bottle of nitroglycerin pills and an explanation of having a bad heart. The road out of town and into the hills hadn't seen new asphalt in decades. The responsivists had worked on the opposite side of the island, and it took an hour to reach the area. The sun had crested the horizon during the drive, revealing primal rainforest and jungle that hemmed in the road like a continuous emerald tunnel.